Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire.
And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are talking about great women today on the Morning Show. And in part one, specifically, talking about the Susan B. Anthony Women of Influence Awards. These awards have been given over the last several years. And coming up on Friday, March 6th, will be the latest such event at which some very important and influential women here in southeastern Wisconsin will be honored. And we're here to talk about two of the award winners who will be honored on Friday evening. And we have with us in the studio, first of all, Gwida Brown, who's been on the Morning Show any number of times, today wearing her hat as a member of, I suppose, the steering committee for the 2020 Susan B. Anthony Awards, Women of Influence Awards. We also have with us today someone who's also been a part of the Morning Show before, Artis Mosley. And it is her mother, Mary Lou Mahone, who is one of the recipients of the 2020 Lifetime Achievement Awards for the Women of Influence. So she is going to be sharing some of the story of her amazing mother as part of this conversation. Gwida Brown, Artis Mosley, we welcome both of you to the Morning Show.
Thanks for having us, Greg.
Great to have you here. So maybe we should start out with why this is, in effect, a very special year for the Susan B. Anthony Women of Influence Awards. I mean, each and every year it's a special, exciting thing, but there is something about the calendar of 2020 that makes this especially timely. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is the 100th year of suffrage for women, so we're really excited about celebrating that, as well as this year we actually have two recipients of the Lifetime Achievement Award, Gina Madrigano-Fribas from Carthage College, and Mary Lou Mahone is the first ever posthumous award winner.
So we'll be talking about her story in just a bit. Gwida, what can you tell us about the origins of the Susan B. Anthony Women of Influence Awards? When did this begin and how? And what can you tell us about what was, in a sense, the central impetus?
So we really just wanted to celebrate women. Well, it was before my time. But we're calling it our 30th year. And last year I actually had written history of it, but we don't have 30 consecutive years. So it started as honoring a woman who served Kenosha with her volunteerism and acting as a representative for women. And the first year, Sonny Yelton Stanley, I believe now, was honored. And it was just sort of a event. And then as it progressed, we added scholarships and nonprofit grants, and it became a fundraiser. For the first number of years, all of the money went to domestic abuse and sexual assault organizations. So I was a recipient when I was at the Women and Children's Horizons as the executive director and active then. And so over the years, it sort of has evolved. This is, I believe, our fourth year honoring women of influence as well. So about 4 years ago, maybe five, we recognized that not everyone was going to rise to the level of a Lifetime Achievement Award. And there were so many women out there who deserved recognition. So we added the Women of Influence Award. So we honor women of influence in the nonprofit, and it's either business, government, nonprofit sector. This year it's Sharon Palmaville from the Sharing Center. Woman to Watch Under 40, and this year it's Laura Cox from Acupuncture and Wellness of Wisconsin. And Arts and Education, and this year it's Pat Demas from Kenosha Unified School District. And every now and then we've recognized that we really have to honor a couple people. So this year, like I said, Mary Lou Mahone is the very first posthumous award winner. But in the past, we've had a couple Lifetime Achievement Award winners. One time we did. So it's shaping up to be a really good year. And ticket sales end on Friday the 28th. Yes, Friday the 28th. So we really want, or I guess Saturday, but no, Friday the 28th. That darn leap year. So we really want people to have their last opportunity to purchase tickets.
So tomorrow will be the deadline then for people to get their tickets purchased for this. You've been talking about we wanted to and so on. Can you help us understand who exactly has been over the years? And I suspect it's not always been the same.
It has not been. And so, yes, that we has changed. But the last several years, we have three organizations that serve women in Kenosha, and they are the Kenosha Women's Network, the American Association of University Women Kenosha Chapter, and Tempo Kenosha. But we couldn't do it without funding. So we also have money from the Women's Fund, which is part of the Kenosha Community Foundation. And the Labor Times supports us as well. They are the ones who do the booklets.
Tell us a little bit about the process by which nominations are procured and then discussed in terms of coming up with whoever the actual award winners will be. Take us inside that process.
So there are 12 women on the committee, I believe. And we search for nominations through the community. We put that information out there. We really try to get people involved in this process, as well as the nonprofit grant writing and the scholarships. We award scholarships for college education to non-traditionally aged women who live in Kenosha County. And so we try to get the word out to HR directors and the schools and the nonprofits, and the Kenosha News helps us, WGTD helps us. We really just try to get the word out. And this year, 2 years ago, we were up against a space consideration because of another event that was held at Marina Shores. So we actually made it a little bit earlier, and it hovers right around International Women's Day. So last year we were lucky it landed right on the day. So it's the first Friday in March. And so we had to back up our deadline a little bit. We used to do it closer to the middle of March. So we backed up the deadline. So it was before Christmas. We asked for those nominations and applications to come in. And then one day we all sit around and hash it out. Sometimes it's never a popularity contest, but it certainly helps when we know who the winner is and or who the nominees are and how they've impacted our community. Someone like Mary Lou Mahone was so obvious, and so we sometimes it doesn't take any conversation. It's almost sort of a foregone conclusion, and we just decide on, you know, what level they're supposed to be at. When the nominations come in, we ask, do they only want them to be recognized for one award? So if they only want them to be for the Lifetime Achievement Award, we won't consider them for the Women of Influence Awards. But most people, the nominations come in and, you know, they're pretty happy with any consideration that they get. And so we just hash that out and make the decision all in one evening with amongst the committee.
Wow. And I should think that's probably a very happy kind of experience. That is, what could be better than to consider the great work of great women making a powerful impact in the community. I mean, that it must be nice to be able to set some time aside to think about that and to reflect on that and to perhaps even learn about important work being done that maybe wasn't even on your radar.
Yeah, absolutely. It's wonderful to sit around and have those discussions. What's even better is Becky Mataska-Mentink is one of the members of the committee. And so she'll leave the room and go and call the people we want to honor and make sure that they're going to be available, make sure that they even knew they were nominated, because sometimes that happens, that people don't know that they're even nominated. And so she'll leave and then come back into the room and say, they're in. And it's really quite exciting to just feel that energy and feel like we're really able to recognize deserving women who maybe haven't gotten their due previously.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today with Gwida Brown about the upcoming Susan B. Anthony Awards, including the Women of Influence Awards and Lifetime Achievement Awards that will be bestowed on Friday evening, March 6th, in a big event at Madrigano Marina Shores. And Gwida, explain what actually unfolds at that event. I mean, we can probably kind of imagine that it's something's going to be eaten and some speeches are going to be given, but fill in the gaps. I mean, what really happens?
So, yeah, I was just telling artists, it's I always tell people it's like having a wedding reception, but there's no spouse. That for the honorees, it's like your very own wedding reception. When Mary Wagner won the award, she likened it to an Irish wake where the person is still alive. So it's a great big party, and it's the biggest women's event in Kenosha. Over 400 people attend. There are men in attendance as well. I know people are always a little worried about that, but yes, absolutely, there are men in attendance. And we spend the first hour, it's a cocktail hour. And so we really, it is like having your own party. The winners, it's just so exciting, the energy in the room. And I almost feel bad because then about 6 o'clock, I'm the one who has to like calm everybody down and get them seated. And you feel bad about it because they're not there to listen to me. They're there to see their friends who won this award. And it's just so much fun. So that's when the speeches start. We give away the money for the scholarships and for the nonprofits. And then we do dinner. And then we do the awards, the Women of Influence, and then the Lifetime Achievement Awards at the end. There's a raffle, so people can support us by buying raffle tickets as well. But quite honestly, by the end of the night, and it's not that long of a night. That's the other thing. It's about from 5 until 8:30. Last year, the basketball maybe was going, something was going on, or 2 years ago, and we were really conscious of the clock, getting them out of there. So at the end, we do the raffle drawing, and it's almost like nobody knew it happened. So we're really trying to it's a very compact night, but it's just so much fun.
Packed with fun from the sounds of it. So, of course, the all the awards mean a lot, but of course, in some sense, the big headline award is the Lifetime Achievement Award. And there are two winners, and one of them is very much still with us and was invited to be part of this conversation, but is just a little too shy about.
No, she's actually out of town. She had asked me early on if we needed her for anything, and we don't always get the opportunity to do this interview. So I said, "No, you're fine. We only need you that night." And then,
Bummer. Right. Well, on another occasion, we'll speak with Gina Madrigano-Fribas, but just say a quick word about the kind of things that she has done that makes her such a deserving recipient of a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yeah, so Gina is very active in our community. She actually started Tempo Kenosha. And that's a really big deal. That's a professional women's organization. They meet for lunch once a month. And again, it gives women an opportunity to support one another. And the fact that Gina was at the helm of that, she's also been very active in Carthage College. She is on there. They are now celebrating 150 years this year of allowing women into the school.
Yes.
And so she was very integral in that celebration and those observations. So she's really made an impact in our community for women especially. And so that's why it's so important to recognize her as well.
Excellent. We really seriously hope that we'll be able to have a conversation with her sometime to talk more thoroughly about the work that she has done. Yep. But we're so happy that we have in the room Artis Mosley, who is, of course, part of the wonderful Mahone family. And it is her mother, Mary Lou Mahone, who is going to be the recipient of the other Lifetime Achievement Award. And so we're anxious, Artis, for you to share a few thoughts about your extraordinary mother. And first of all, how did you greet the news that she was going to be given this Lifetime Achievement Award?
I was at work, and it took me back. For my mother to receive this award in this day and age says a lot. My mother was a suffragette when she was doing what she was doing, which was only the right thing to do. For her to be honored by the women of Kenosha, the citizens of Kenosha, is so very important to our family. I mean, we're a proud family, without a doubt. We're not ones that look for recognition, but for our mother individually to be recognized says a lot.
Yeah. How long has your mom been gone?
Oh, too long.
Yeah.
Too long. She's been gone 20 plus years.
Wow. I only ask that because I think that says a lot about her legacy.
Yes.
That more than two decades after she left this earth, she is still so remembered and her legacy is so deeply valued. I mean, again, that says something about the lasting influence that she has had on the community. And it also says something about the rest of you and how you have worked so diligently to keep her legacy alive.
I think that's because what my mother stood for and what she's still standing for. Mother was always there for anyone and everyone. Mm. And she made sure, you know, that those that didn't have had an opportunity to have. She always spoke about the importance of voting. You know, don't let anyone tell you you don't have a right. And that right always went to whether it was your education, housing, food, you know. And to this day, we as her family, we are continue to keep her legacy alive because it's so very important. I mean, look at the country we live in right now. So many things are trying to be taken from us, and we can't have that.
Right.
And we feel our mother's spirit. She would probably come and slap us if we didn't do what we were supposed to do.
Absolutely. And
you know, it's a good thing. You can go to bed and wake up in the morning and look in the mirror. And so we were raised to do what is commonplace for us, but for others it seems like it's difficult. And all you have to do is look at your fellow human being and you know what to do.
Tell us more about the work that your mother did specifically as a suffragette and the kinds of things that she specifically did that gave her energy and gave her purpose in terms of that specific cause.
Well, I can go back to when Ida B. Wells said something about, I will not walk behind you, I will walk next to you, or you will follow me. And that was mother. I remember as a child that she took us to different marches regarding integration. When Governor Wallace was here in town, I was right there with her.
Wow.
When it came time for the Boys and Girls Club to be formed, mother was very, very integral part of that. She was very important when it came to the Shalom Center. She, and if that's not suffragette, I'm sure everyone recalls when we had the lines for food going around the women and children's office. And though, I mean, there was vast things of that sort. Mother was very integral in terms of when new families would come to Kenosha, that they had proper housing. And when I say new families, I'm referring to African-American families. That was one of the things that was part of the cultural. You have your, whoever it was would come, and there would be housing for them. But then it wasn't just African-American, because everyone knew that if you were being evicted or you needed a place to stay, go see Mrs. Mahone. She would guide you in the way. If you were hungry, she would guide you in a way. And I think because of my mother, that there are so many people in Kenosha who are standing on her shoulders. She was the warrior. My mother was a suffragette when no one else knew about being a suffragette. All they knew was Susan B. Anthony, but now they know about Mary Lou Mahone. She definitely stood for what that meant and will always stand for that. She is the reason why some of our female lawmakers are where they're at. She's the reason why KUSD is where it's at. She was not afraid, and she always spoke the truth that so many of us are always afraid to say. And she did it in such an elegant way, you'd say, did she just slap me? And you were slapped and never realized it.
Wow. I'm glad you touched on that, because that's something that I wanted to ask you about. I mean, you used the term warrior to describe your mother. I mean, when it came to this kind of work, at least, she was a warrior. I wanted to know more about, in a sense, what her personality was like. Was it that of a warrior? It sounds like it really wasn't. I mean, she was, in fact, a warrior, but a woman of class and elegance and graciousness, and that's one of the best ways to get doors opened and to get work done. Tell us more about what she was like as a person, and what kind of role you think that made in the impact she was able to have on the community.
My mother, her faith was first. She was a very devout woman in terms of her religion, and she made sure that her children were part of that. Mom was an excellent cook. Mom was mom. Okay, she was mommy, mom, grandma, gaga. And not one of us can say anything negative about our mother, except for the fact that we feel she left us too soon.
Yeah.
She was a loving wife. And the things I think, you know, along with being that warrior, everyone understood that Mary Lou loved you. She treated you with respect no matter who you were. She just wouldn't back down if you were doing wrong. But she was a very loving individual. And as you said, classy. My mother, very classy woman. Very, very, very classy. Very educated, even though she graduated from high school. She didn't have a college degree, but you could put her up against persons who had a four-year, whatever it was, PhD, and she could back them down very easily. Very well read, and a distinguished writer.
I know from my experience, I was lucky enough to be in Mary Lou Mahone's presence several times as a young upstart, and oh my goodness, intimidating. Intimidating and passionate. I think those are the two words that just even walking into a room and seeing this sort of larger than life little woman who just exuded passion and caring, and really from, you know, from my perspective, I guess, thinking, oh my gosh, I you're in the presence of greatness, honestly, and afraid to say anything, for not because she was mean or cruel, but because you didn't want to look stupid in front of her. I mean, that's seriously sort of my, you know, you just sort of sit back and take it all in, and it was just really amazing to see her at work.
I think what you're describing is somebody who in a sense, demands your best, or or you demand from yourself your best, just because it's somebody who sets the bar so high in terms of what it means to be a great human being and to do great things in the community. Artist, tell us where you think this came from. I mean, in terms of who your mother was, for instance, did she have parents who were role models in this respect? Or do you feel like this is something that kind of sprang, in a sense, from her?
It didn't spring from her. That's just the way Granny Graham and Boucher and Grandpa Ray's mother, also along with the situations and different incidents that she had to be a part of. I remember her telling us as a child that she was chased with an umbrella by a couple girl students because they kept calling her nigger. And because of things like that, do you see what I'm saying?
Sure. She was shaped by what she experienced to a large extent.
Yes, she realized in high school that the teachers always thought of her as someone exceptional because she would outshine the other students who had more things to offer in terms of the materialistic things.
Mm.
My great-grandmother, Mary Lou Elder, was one of the first black women to live in Kenosha. She was also one of the first black entrepreneurs here in Kenosha because she would walk her wares, her baking goods, down the cobblestone streets of Kenosha.
Mm.
And Mom got a very, very, very productive lesson from that. She also had those lessons where even I, as a child, had to go with Granny and Mom to go clean homes down on 3rd Avenue.
Mm.
Because she said she did not want her children to have to clean toilets. But in order to have a living, we did what we had to do. And sometimes we all have to do what we have to do. And Mom had to do just that. But Mom was given the opportunity to be herself. Because she had a strong husband, our father, Arthur, and the two of them were forces that had to be reckoned with, one way or the other.
Mm.
And to this day, that still holds true. If you look at my brother, Tim, he's just all over the map. And he and several citizens in Kenosha formed, at first, the Mary Lou Mahone Fund. And then when Dad died, we added his name to it. And I mean, here we stand because of Mother's legacy that we're capable of giving out all these scholarships to graduating seniors. And we were helping with women's health issues through the Kenosha Community Foundation. I mean, this award is something that there should be one for everyone. Okay. And what Guida and her committee have done is they brought light to it. And, you know, Sharon Palmerville, a very personal family friend of ours. Some of the prior recipients are personal friends of ours.
Mm.
Joan Wilk. And two of my mother's best friends. Okay, one, excuse me, is Vonda Kinderman, and the other would be Natalie Troja. I mean, they were like little girls when they were together.
Mm.
And to this day, there is still that. You know, they always called Mom Bella, Bella. Mm. And to this day, Vonda will always say that, my Bella. Mm. And when I see Natalie, she says she always misses her mom. And I can't leave out Joan Wilk. And I remember Mom speaking of Miss Guida. Even though she might have been an upstart, Guida's name was always in my mother's conversation.
Mm.
Because Guida has the same strength, the same format that my mother had. Mm. So I have to say thank you to Guida.
Mm.
You know, I mean, and if you notice, it's not about race.
Right, I was just going to say.
We're talking about human rights here.
Right.
And my mother always fought for human rights. Because she was a woman of color, yes, she had a double fight.
Right.
Actually, a triple fight. She was a woman of color. She was a woman, and she was a mother.
Mm.
So that describes my mother, Mary Lou.
Wow. And of course, to bear all of that, in a sense, and to bear all of that so graciously and courageously and so on, says a tremendous amount. And I'm so glad that you talked about the way in which she so deeply appreciated the work of others. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there are formidable people, whether they're a woman or a man, who are very much caught up in their own efforts and largely oblivious to the good work being done by others. And then there are those who know that the issues that they're working on are a lot bigger than they are, and that it takes all kinds of people in all kinds of places to be part of the fight. And it sounds like your mother had a real deep awareness and understanding and appreciation of the good work that all kinds of other people were doing. I think that says a lot about her, too.
Well, you know, we look at how we are right now. My mother always brought in children, brought the children, involved the youth. Hmm. And if we don't continue that type of attitude, this country, this world is going to be in sad standings. It's about we as adults passing it on to our youth, but passing it on at a young age. Hmm. Not wait till they get to high school. You know, and you have the kids that want their little Christmas toys and whatever. So at Christmas, Christmas time, those items you got this year, and they're worthy of giving up next year, give them away. Don't keep them in your closet. You know, I mean, it's going out, helping those who are less fortunate than we are. Hmm. And that was Mom. Hmm.
I have a feeling that she would maybe be a little taken aback at being given an award like this, but surely she would deeply appreciate the spirit with which this event is put together and mm-hmm. and this way of honoring an array of women and the good work that they're doing. I should think that makes you feel really good.
Makes me feel better than good. Okay. I know I'm emotional because it's mother and speaking of her and bringing up the thoughts, but I live with that every day because I try very hard to do what she would have done. And she had some big steps. And, you know, you just can't, you can't follow everybody's steps, but you can attempt to. And so that's what we're just trying to do. It's Mary Lou Mahone, my mommy, woman who I miss very much. Our family misses her. And I know this community misses her, but we can't live on missing. We have to live on doing. And if we don't continue to do, shame on us.
Right. And you're right. At this moment in which we find ourselves, a lot of this work is more important than ever.
Yes. So. And not take it so personally. You know, get up. Whose ego are we living on? We can't live on our egos. An ego will not get you fed. It will not keep you clothed. It will not give you an education. An ego will hurt you if you allow it to interfere with the positive things that we need in this world. Mm.
It sounds like your mother, for as formidable as she was, as gifted and capable as she was also a woman of beautiful humility.
Yes, very humble. That's why it's a little bit difficult for me to say, okay. All righty. Yeah, it's what you're supposed to do. If you look for an award or reward for what you do, what good is the action? I don't understand that. I really don't. But that's how it's set up. Okay.
Well, this is an award that helps us all remember your amazing mother. And in some ways, just as important to remember the great work that she did and to understand the legacy that is left to the rest of us, men and women alike, to build on all that she accomplished, she and your husband. I'm glad you mentioned your husband. I mean, her husband. I'm glad you mentioned your father and the fact that he was a really important part of what she was able to do.
Yes, yes, and will always be. Hmm. He will always be. It was Art and Mary Lou, Mary Lou and Art, and to this day is the same. Hmm.
So artist has been sharing about her mother, Mary Lou Mahone, and she, along with Gina Madrigano-Fribas, will be the Lifetime Achievement Award winners with the Susan B. Anthony Awards, which will be coming up on Friday, the 6th of March. So, Guida, for anybody who is interested in attending, first of all, why is it important to attend? It's probably important for us to underscore the purpose of this event beyond just the awards that are dispensed and so on.
Yeah, I think this is, like I said, it's the premier event for women in Kenosha. And I think it's important to attend because the fight isn't over. As artist so eloquently was pointing out, this is not an award that you get it and then you're done. This is how we continue to support our community. And it happens to be for women, but it's not just about women. And so it's really important to be there to support the work that's being done in our community.
Absolutely. So we hope people will really seriously consider the possibility of purchasing tickets to attend the festivities on Friday evening, March 6th. If people are interested in doing that, what do they do?
They can go to Eventbrite, and so it's eventbrite.com, and then search for Susan B., and we'll be the first or second thing that pops up. If they have any questions, they can email susanbdinner@gmail.com.
Very good. Guida Brown, part of the steering committee for this year's Susan B. Anthony Awards. And, of course, it is a big year for women as we look back over 100 years of women's suffrage and other milestones that make it a perfect year to celebrate the legacy of women. And, of course, we especially remember with exceptional fondness the great work done by Mary Lou Mahone, who is going to be one of the two Lifetime Achievement Award winners at this year's event. Guida Brown, Artis Mosley, I'm so grateful to both of you for being part of the morning show today. This was fun and inspiring. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg.
We finish out today's morning show with an excerpt from my interview back in 2009 with Mark Hrabowski, author of The Supremes, a saga of Motown dreams, success, and betrayal, an examination of the career of Diana Ross, Mary Wilson, and Florence Ballard. I began my interview by asking him if he wrote this book as a fan of the group.
You know, the funny thing is, I didn't think I was. You know, I grew up in that era. I was a teenager, young, actually, about 10 years old when they, you know, started becoming really popular. I don't know if it was cool for teenage boys to be Supremes fans then. It was almost like a secret pleasure, you know what I mean? There was something about it that, you know, we couldn't admit to it, but we'd always listen to it. And I think through the years, I started admitting to myself that, you know, I really love these. I really love the Supremes. You know? That's something you would say in the company of, you know, in the locker room or something like that.
Right.
But it's true because I think there's something about, you know, you mentioned opera before. It's operatic. It's, you know, there are numerous musical influences that went into it. It's the genius of Berry Gordy and the genius of Holland Dozier Holland, the genius of Diana Ross and her getting how those songs could only have been sung to become popular the way they were. And I just think that through the years, this congealing, you know, it dawned on me that, you know, 12 number one hits. And not only that, 12 number one hits, because Mariah Carey now has 12 number one hits, and I don't think anybody would place her on the same pedestal. The fact that they had 12 number one hits from 61 to 70, now consider what changes were going on in music during those years. That was like the pop idol era to the Beatles era to the heavy Beatles era to the Stax Volt, you know, quote-unquote real R&B, you know, real black music kind of era, to Woodstock, to Altamont, and through all that time, the Supremes were having number one hits. At a time when the girl group sound, per se, was thought to be dead. Now, there has to be something very, very special about that. It can't be luck. It can't be a fluke. It can't be that they hit on some formula, you know, that was good for a couple of years of hits. We're talking about 8-9 years of ineffable success, you know. These were not only number one hits. These were hits that dominated the charts.
And not only that, of course, but we're also talking about black artists who were incredibly popular across a wide swath of the American public. I mean, including white guys like you and me. And there were a lot of people with us who were really enchanted with the Supremes. And, I mean, in a sense, this was the kind of breakthrough that was really uncommon, all but unheard of at that moment in time.
And the funny thing is, it was something that Gordy envisioned even from the late 50s. But he needed a muse. He needed a vehicle to be able to do it. And it didn't happen until the Supremes, and I don't think it would have happened. You know, when you look back at Motown, there are songs by other groups like Nowhere to Run or Dancing in the Streets or Money by Barrett Strong, songs that really were better than any Supreme song, more stood the test of time better. But nobody ever had a consistent run, where the excellence just kept coming one after another after another after another. And it's true that more than any other Motown group, they did make that transition. It was called crossover. You know, that was the great dream of all black musicians and record company executives to cross over into the white market and sell just as many there, if not more, than in the black community. And that didn't happen until the Supremes. And if you listen to that track you had before, Back in My Arms Again, you know why. If you dissect that, as you could dissect any other Supremes track, you know why. The mystery is in there. Because, you know, I'm not going to go into the technicalities, but I did interview the Holland brothers, Brian and Eddie Holland, two-thirds of the producing songwriting team, Holland Dozier Holland, which was responsible for 10 of the 12 number one Supremes hits. But, you know, I sat for hours talking to these guys about the chassis of each of these songs. And it is true, it was done in a very meticulous, almost mad scientist way, in a way that would be amenable to the white market. Like, the beat was called 4x4. That was the drum beat that you heard, which was the drum striking on every beat, like bang, 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 instead of every other beat, which is the way it was usually done for R&B records. Because as it was explained to me, white audiences would clap on that 4x4 beat. They would clap on that bang, 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 bang. Whereas black audiences would clap on the clap, clap. You know what I'm saying?
Right, on just the backbeat, as opposed to...
Just on the backbeat. There was a difference in the way black and white audiences heard and reacted to music. So when you listen to Back of My Arms Again, for example, you would hear that Benny Benjamin, that was the great drummer, legendary drummer of Motown, just nailing in the pocket that 4x4 beat. And that was practically on every single Supremes record until later on, when Reflections, you know, that era started coming about, Love Child, when they started changing the thematic content as well as how the music sounded. But this was how it was made. It was black music by black musicians called the Funk Brothers in later years. That was the Motown house band. But playing white music. It was an unbelievable formula, and it could only have worked, I think, with Diana Ross out front with that gossamer kind of voice that you could almost reach through. That's what made it all work.
One of the Holland Brothers you quote is saying, we didn't want to be just another bunch of black guys making music as a cause. We didn't want to put all our energies year after year into making music three people would listen to that would never get beyond a black radio station and the jukebox in some dingy blues club on the edge of the docks.
Right.
I mean, they were looking at something a whole lot bigger than that, and of course managed to achieve it.
And they were groomed in that respect by Gordy. They were just kids. This is another of the secrets of Motown. Gordy would comb through the community, not for veteran R&B guys, but for young guys who didn't have that you know, we've got to do this R&B thing here. We've got to go out to the clubs and do it. He wanted people who would just make hits, you know, come in, and whether they were drawing country influence, you know, or operatic influences with I Hear a Symphony, or anything that would produce a hit record. He wanted that in the back of their minds, and that was one of the key successes of Motown.
We're speaking with Mark Hrabowski. We're talking about his book, The Supremes. I want to ask you just a couple other kind of general questions, and then we'll dig into this fantastic story. I'm wondering how you went about not only telling this story, but sort of going about trying to untangle so many of the knots which have come about over the years. I mean, because there is also wrapped up in this story not only great success, but also intense unhappiness and resentment and so on, and which in some respects has only grown over the years. And I'm just wondering, first of all, as someone really trying to tell this story as truthfully as possible, as you really clearly are in this book, how do you get past that? I mean, particularly when you have someone at the heart of this story like Diana Ross, who obviously attracted so much antagonism from those who worked closely with her. How do you figure out what is truth and what is just sort of bitterness and sort of the remaking of history to make kind of a nasty person look even more nasty? I don't envy you that task.
That wasn't my intention, by the way. I mean, people have been saying this in reviews and so on. All the reviews have been quite good. But there's always this theme somewhere that it's another negative look at Diana Ross. I didn't set out to do that.
Sure, and just to be clear, I'm not saying that you did that. I'm saying that, you know, for instance, the people you interviewed recalling these events.
That's exactly right.
I wonder, as the author, I mean, I think one of the things you do in your book is you're pretty clear to say, in many cases, stories get embellished over time and things are given this sort of theatrical bent about, the way certain escapades were described or whatever. But I mean, as the author, what led you and guided you in trying to tell this story truthfully and in trying to be fair to everybody involved?
Well, that's exactly what I was trying to do. There, as you say, I mean, the Supremes may be the most written about group other than the Beatles and Elvis in history, but everything that had been written about them was sort of bathed in this celebrity pseudo-journalism, you know, this tabloid-style gossip where the music was basically an afterthought and everything was geared around Diana Ross and her divahood and all that kind of stuff. It's a very difficult job, not the least because Diana Ross and Mary Wilson themselves don't seem to even remember much of what happened back then. I don't know if it's a case of trying to push it out of their minds or whatever. I mean, Mary has said she actually, when she wrote Dream Girl, her autobiography in the early 80s, that she had to go to see therapists for months just to be able to remember some of this stuff. I could only imagine if Flo Ballard had lived, what she would have had to do to recall some of the stuff, because she was thrown out like yesterday's trash by Motown. It was the shame of Motown, and it killed her, basically, on a figurative level. So, there's a lot of pain involved, but that doesn't excuse why Diana Ross has such a superficial memory of what happened. She's of no use at all to a biographer. She's had several books published which were failures, I'm very happy to say. But even Mary Wilson's took great liberties with the truth. So I almost had to be a detective in this and running down the threads, you know, and corroborating, you know, with other people how it happened. I can only hope I got most of it right.
Mark Grabowski is the author of The Supremes, a saga of Motown dreams, success, and betrayal, published by Da Capo Press. This interview was recorded and originally broadcast back in 2009. And we're planning on sharing this interview with Mark Grabowski in its entirety as part of the Morning Show podcast this weekend. Tomorrow on the Morning Show, a conversation I just finished recording with three people involved in a very important effort in the city of Racine, a year-long effort called Opening Our Hearts and Minds to End Racism. You can hear tomorrow my conversation with Sister Ann Pratt, co-director of the Racine Dominican Center for Justice Resources, Carl Fields from Racine Interfaith Coalition, and Jim Schatzman from Racine Vocational Ministries. That is tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. We're approaching 9 o'clock.